And welcome back to Current State on WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. A reminder that tonight's pop-up stories gathering at Red Cedar Spirits in East Lansing is sold out, for lack of a better word. It's a free event, but because of space constraints, we had to limit the number of attendees this time around. If you wanted to come out but you did not get a spot, we apologize. Looking ahead, we're going to do everything we can to keep our growing audience in mind when we plan our venues. The heat is on is tonight's topic for our storytellers. Red Cedar Spirits, Merritt Road, East Lansing, starting at 6 o'clock. Well, the end of the month means a quick look back at Michigan's top news stories in state government and politics to help us drive that discussion. No, this is not a driverless vehicle. Veteran Capitol correspondent, host of Off the Record on Michigan Public Television, Tim Skubick.
Hey, Marky, how you
welcome
doing?
Back. Nice to see you. And Emily Lawler of MLive. Welcome back, Emily.
Thanks for having me.
For better or for worse, a lot in the Lansing area came to a halt back on the 19th for a few hours for Donald Trump's visit to the summit in Diamonddale. The Lansing area visit was, I believe, the first of several rallies where Trump tried to appeal to African Americans. Let's listen to part of that appeal.
Hillary Clinton would rather provide a job to a refugee from overseas than to give that job to unemployed African American youth in cities like Detroit who have become refugees in their own country.
And that whole discussion has continued almost unabated ever since Lansing. Did Donald Trump's message begin to change on his Lansing visit, Tim? Did you read it that way?
This thing is changing by the hour. What time is it?
Yeah.
You know, it was startling in the fact that he took about 15 minutes of a 41-minute speech to talk about, courting, if you will, the African-American vote in a community that is 98% white, a little town called Diamonddale, which is not exactly an urban center. So it was interesting. The venue was unique, but it was also vintage Donald Trump. His message was very clear. Look at folks, you got nothing to lose because the Democrats have not done anything for you. They take you for granted. They come around and court you when it's time to vote. And then after we vote, they forget about you. And so, you know what? What do you got to lose by going with me? The African-American community did not take it well. They thought maybe they were trying to be used. But look, there was a hidden agenda in also what he was doing. I think he was also speaking to more independent and moderate white people who say, you know, well, maybe Donald Trump isn't a racist, quote, end quote. He is reaching out, and that's appropriate. Does he get a bunch of African-American votes? Probably not. But he's making the effort, and he's underscoring his belief in this effort by coming to Detroit on Saturday.
Emily, what'd you make of the Diamonddale visit?
I talked to a couple of people who kind of had that perspective, you know, white attendees who came out of the rally thinking like, you know, this is a guy who's trying to reach out. He's trying to make everything equal for everyone. That's an American ideal. So I think to some extent that worked. But, you know, it's funny because, like Tim said, it's a predominantly white town that he gave that speech in. But, you know, the bookends of his visit to Michigan, he had been to a Detroit Economic Club or Economic Club luncheon, something like that, earlier, a week before he came to Diamonddale. And then this week we're expecting him to visit Detroit again. So it's an interesting venue for the African-American
pitch. Well, it's interesting to consider the next visit to Michigan. He's got another visit to Detroit planned for Saturday, where he'll appear before a predominantly African-American church and then interview with the bishop of the church on the Bishop's radio program about...
I think it's a TV show.
A TV show. It could be. I'm sorry if that's...
There is television, Mark.
It has been,
this is sort of like radio with pictures, okay? I'm sorry to correct you.
But you know race and ethnicity will be a part of a large part of the discussion. This sounds like an extraordinary setting. What do you make of this upcoming visit?
Well, where better to go? I mean, there is a tradition of Democratic candidates going into church on Sunday, putting some money in the plate and getting a chance to talk. There's some nif-gnawing going on now as to whether he's actually going to speak to the congregation, and that will be interesting. But let me just backtrack you to the two previous appearances where he's been accused of being tone-deaf. He went into the Detroit Economic Club and basically beat up the city of Detroit as being a disaster because of Democratic policies. Well, if he had read the papers Detroit was in bankruptcy and is coming out of that and looking pretty good. Okay, so he goes to Diamondale and he declares the economics section or the manufacturing section of the economy in Michigan to be, quote, a disaster, excuse me, which is somewhat counter to what Governor Snyder has been telling us and Republicans. So here's two instances where he comes into the state, delivers a message which is out of sync with the Republican message in the state as they're trying to win elections. It's a total disconnect.
Getting back to the courting of African-American voters, it's been pretty widely reported that Trump's numbers will not elect him unless he makes inroads with other groups where his support is weak. In the end, is that what we're seeing here?
I think so. I mean, I think that his comfort zone is definitely white males. Older people tend to support Trump in greater margins. And, you know, there's also some talk of less educated people to the extent that that's a demographic. But, you know, I think that when he's looking to court the African-American community, he's outside of his comfort zone, right? You know, when he first came to Michigan during the primary, for instance, I covered him at an event in Warren that was largely like blue collar workers, factory folks. I think that's kind of his base, his comfort zone. And he's expanding outside of that in Michigan and nationally.
And he also tried to basically apologize for some of the things he said in the past. But we talked about this earlier. If you say to your wife, "I regret that I did something," Mark, is that an apology? The answer is no.
No.
Okay, no, it's not. You have to say, "I'm sorry." He never said, "I'm sorry." He just didn't. He can't bring himself to do that. And that was designed to appeal, I think, to some of the female voters out there who have some concerns about him with that regard. Now, if he were to say, "You know what, I'm sorry that I said my comments about abortion, okay, I'm sorry that I said this," it might help him to move a little bit. But I don't think saying that he regretted saying stuff got the job done. And he's only done it once. He hasn't repeated it on the campaign trail. And as you know from watching politics for years, you have to continually repeat your message over and over again so that it sinks in with the electorate. This was just a walk-by, and I don't think it did any good.
Tim Skubick, Emily Lawler, it's Current State's Month in Review here on 90.5 WKAR. One more Trump question, and I promise we'll move on. We saw Governor Snyder continue to avoid Trump as a topic, even though he's been asked about it a number of times, including by you last week, Tim. Will Rick Snyder stay out of this all the way to November, or could he eventually announce support for Donald Trump?
Next question.
How hard is that to visualize?
I don't think he would ever announce support for Donald Trump. You know, I think he's been he's been adamant in being out of it for this long. I don't know what the advantage would be of jumping in it, you know, kind of too little, too late. So, you know, I'd be interested to see if he did do that, but I don't think it's really on the table. And I think the closest he's really gotten to any discussion of Trump is, you know, kind of saying that Trump's characterization of the manufacturing sector as a disaster didn't exactly line up with what he was seeing in Michigan. So, you know, the closest he's gotten to Trump as a subject was not really a positive.
What is there to report recently from Michigan Democrats and their candidate, Hillary Clinton?
Well, they're hoping that she does well. I think that eventually Michigan will not be in play. I think a couple more polls that come out showing her up by 8 or 9 points could be the end of the Trump juggernaut coming into Michigan. In fact, I don't know this for sure, but I got a feeling that this visit to Detroit may be the one and only.
Yeah.
Unless stuff starts to turn around, because there's only so much money, there's only so much finite time. And you don't take somebody to a place where you don't have a chance of winning. I'm not saying he's out of it in Michigan, but he's got a ways to go. It's an uphill climb. And the Democrats are very happy to have Trump at the top of the ticket because they think in other races that will help them out. So the D's are quite happy. Look, she's got her own problems. You know, if you look at the polling data, which we've all looked at, she's not very popular either. So this clearly is the lesser of two evils, and one of the evils is going to win.
Meanwhile, Attorney General Bill Schuette wants a firewall of sorts, for lack of a better word, between the state human health and services personnel and Flint health officials as they work on Flint water. What's this about?
Well, you sound like you've been reading confidential orders. but I think last week at some point, it came out that there was a secret court order that had been sealed by a judge that was issued to kind of limit communication between the State Department of Health and Human Services and some local agencies in Flint, including the Genesee County Health Department and then also McLaren Hospital. And DHHS is fighting back and saying, well, wait a minute, you know, there's this active question of Legionella. They've got cases of Legionella that they're trying to investigate, and they're saying, you know, we need access to some of the information that's put off limits to thoroughly address the public health crisis.
And is the focus of this Bill Schuette, Rick Snyder? Is that
the
focal point here?
I think the media tries to do that, and it does sort of fit that narrative. But what is going on here is that the governor's point is that if his officials can't talk to the local health officials about the Legionnaires problem, that the people are at risk in Flint. And Mr. Schuette's people, taking note of that, went into the secret document and changed it to address the governor's concerns so that supposedly the state health officials could talk to the local health officials, but the governor's office wasn't buying that. So they continue, and now they trotted out a doctor today who says the people are going to be at risk if our local officials and our state officials can't communicate. So you've got a back and forth in the courts. The governor says he doesn't like the lack of transparency. He'd like to see the court order. But this is part of the back and forth between these two gentlemen who are Republicans and tend to disagree on a number of issues.
So could you argue then these moves by the attorney general are a thinly veiled effort to distance him from a hobbled administration of the same party?
I'm not sure how hard he needs to try at this point. I think he's done a pretty good job differentiating himself, winding up on the opposite side of a lot of court cases. Going back to maybe the representing the retirees in the Detroit bankruptcy was kind of a divisionary point. So, is he perhaps getting farther and farther away from the administration? I think that's a fair conjecture.
Mr. Schuette would say, I'm just doing my job.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm just doing my job.
Let's move on to the confusion at the State School Reform Office. We've been led to believe that the SRO could close many dozens of Michigan schools due to chronic underperformance, but the process has continued to baffle administrators and some number of elected officials as well. Some say they're in the dark. Can you help us understand what's going on
here?
Well,
the rollout of the announcement got everybody's attention because the word 100 schools was thrown out, not a couple of dozen. And they had to sort of begin to walk that back because they weren't going to do that yesterday. Okay, there's a process involved here. And so I think the school reform office probably could have done this a little better by laying the groundwork for such an announcement. There was no need at that point to say anything. And then when it was said, it scared everybody. And now the administration is trying to walk this thing back and clarify that the schools aren't going to be closed tomorrow. The part that I loved about this, the school superintendent who used to have this reform office in his shop, okay, and probably had a little tighter control over it, has said, I had nothing to do with this, folks.
Yeah.
Okay, I know I'm the top educator in Michigan, but don't point your fingers at me because I had nothing to do with this.
We've also been led to believe that in just, pardon me, just a few days, tomorrow I think it is, after it has a chance to crunch the brand new MSTEP and SAT test data, which just came out yesterday, by the way, the school reform office would release an updated list of chronically underperforming Michigan schools. Is that list still going to happen? That's an annual thing, as I understand
right.
it.
Right. I think it happens regularly. It might be legislatively required.
Well, Mike Flanagan traditionally went before both education committees in the legislature and put the list out, and there was no crying and gnashing of teeth like we're having over this. So the data will come out.
Well, and part of the problem, I think, with the rollout of the potential closures announcement is that the list wasn't out yet. So, you know, schools who have maybe been in the bottom 5% for 2 years in a row are saying, like, well, shoot, are we on it a third year? Are we even in danger of this? Do we have to worry? So.
Yeah, do you get the impression we have an important office that is kind of making its way in terms of how it conducts business?
Well, the woman that runs the office was a candidate for state school superintendent, so she must know something about education. I think some people in town have a question, does she know anything about how to coalesce around an issue, and it has caused some problems to the point that the governor made a statement last Friday to kind of come in and clean this mess up, to say that we're going to release the list, there will be transparency, and we're working on this, but no schools are going to be closed immediately.
I just get the impression of an office that knows it has authority, but isn't quite sure how to use that authority.
Well, and don't forget that it recently, or I guess last year, was moved under the Department of Technology Management and Budget and out of kind of the Department of Education right. umbrella. So, you know, it might be a communications issue between education community and this office, or just kind of the, you know, the effects of being plucked out of a department where education is all they do.
Can we also comment on the test scores that came out? Do you have a second for that?
Absolutely.
This is an amazing rollout yesterday. The lead was 2/3 of the students are more proficient this year than they were last year. Now, on the surface, how does it sound to you?
Great.
Yeah, it does. Okay, that means if you score 24 out of 100 on the score last year and you moved to 26, you would now have improved.
Yeah.
The fact of the matter is there was one grade, the fifth grade, in the entire state of Michigan that reached 50% proficiency. Hmm. All the other grades, 3 through 11, flunked the test. Now, please be aware, the education department does not like to use the word pass or fail or flunk, that these are diagnostic tests to help us learn how to teach our children better. Mom and dad who are sitting at home want to know, did Johnny and Janie pass the damn test or not? Mm-hmm. And most of them didn't, pardon my French.
So many ways to spin the
It was a nice spin, though.
Spin
and some people, some in the media actually got sucked in by it mm-hmm. and said, hey, 2/3 of the students did better than they did last year.
This month, Attorney General Bill Schuette rejoined the fight involving the straight ticket voting ban. And this was the week before last. He wants this controversial measure that was signed into law last December reinstated. Where does this sit right now?
Yeah, basically in court is the short answer.
The Sixth, does it sit in circuit, the Sixth Circuit Court?
I believe it's still in the Sixth Circuit Court, yes. Yeah. So, you know, going back to kind of the rationale behind implementing this law, you know, Republicans who pushed it and ultimately signed off on it said kind of, you know, this will force people to flip the ballot over, look at nonpartisan offices, and also kind of consider candidates individually and not based just on the party. Whereas Democrats said, hold up, this is going to create really, really long lines. We're not sure what the effects will be. And also, there's some thought that Democratic voters may use the straight ticket option more often, so it could be a disadvantage to Democrats in the
long
run.
It should be noted that 40 other states have a ban on straight party lines, so it's not unique in that regard. But Emily's right, the D's do say this is another part of a pattern of the Republicans to depress the vote. And, of course, the Republicans would disagree, but we have that back and forth, and the Sixth Circuit could make a decision. I talked to Mark Brewer, who is working on this case, former Democratic Party chair. They said if they lose it at the Sixth, in all likelihood, they will go to the U.S. Supreme Court. Mm. But the clock is ticking here. September the 9th is the deadline for deciding what's on the ballot and whether this is in or out.
Emily, you covered the Democratic convention, state convention, last week. What did you take away from that?
You know, it was kind of low-key. There was, you know, a set number of delegates who were voting on candidates for things like the State Board of Education, university boards that are elected popularly, and then Supreme Court candidates. So,
did you encounter the woman rumored to be the Democratic candidate in the 8th District? By any chance, Susanna Shrelly?
Yes, she spoke at
the. She was there.
She spoke, and I thought she did a really good job. Actually, her speech was really, really concise, and I think that she kind of went into her background a little bit and growing up working at a family diner and how hard her parents worked. And you know, I think that people were definitely listening while she was talking, so that's a good first step.
At the Republican gathering on the same day, one longtime Republican from Dearborn, Bill Runco, said of Donald Trump, if we don't elect him, we don't elect anybody on this ticket. Tim, what are you hearing lately about down-ticket Republicans in Michigan races?
Well, there is a concern. They don't like to talk a lot about that because it sort of gives more legs to the story. But the Democrats are pumping this thing pretty good. Particularly, you also have to put this mark in the context of the straight-ticket voting, that it's an up thing for the D's if they can get straight-ticket voting as it affects the bottom of the ticket. But look, there's concern that Trump's not going to do well, and some Republicans may not show up at the polls. I'm not sure I agree with that, but there's danger here, and they need 9 seats in the House to take back control. And I would say the Democrats have a shot at that. It's not a foregone conclusion they will, but they're in the hunt.
They made positive noises of this at the convention, of course. They think they can flip the House.
Yeah, of course. And they would need 9 seats to flip the House. And the other thing is Trump could be a drag on the tickets in some areas of the state, but perhaps a boost to the ticket in other areas. There are some competitive seats in Macomb County, for instance, or Northern Michigan.
So. I want to thank both of you for joining us here today. It's Current States Month in Review. Tim Skubick, thank you. Emily Lawler, best of luck, and thanks to both of you.
Catch you later, man.
It's never too early or too late to foster excitement for the fields of science, technology, engineering, and math. The STEM subjects, right? At least that's how iTech sees it. We'll learn more about the role of the Information Technology Empowerment Center here in Lansing with a couple of those involved. That's coming up on Current State. And what do you get when you combine cooking, conversation, and television? Brooke Allen, what do you get?
Well, Mark, you get A Great Recipe, Jared Bopkin, and Hell's Kitchen, all of which I learned a little bit more about just a few weeks ago.
Jared, please explain your dish to the chefs.
I have a Mexican tostada with black bean salsa, tomatillo sauce, and a tomato salad on top.
When I look at food, we refer to it as being tight. You know, you want it to be, you want to be able to see all the different ingredients. It's a little bit loose.
Actually, nice flavor.
Oh, wow. Tough on this one.
At Blue Team, you need 7 to tie and 8 to win. Chefs, time to vote. Really good indeed. That is a win for the blue team.
I caught up with Jared Bopkin on a hot summer blue sky day at the Bayview Yacht Club in Detroit with the Detroit skyline behind us and junior sailors trying to learn how to sail behind us. You might recognize Jared from season 15 of Hell's Kitchen with Gordon Ramsay. It was taped in 2014, although it only aired earlier this year. He finished 4th. Jared didn't play chef as a kid. He really just wanted to be an X-Men. But then he realized that wouldn't pay the bills. So he was a locksmith by day and a professional poker player by night. But then he says he started getting the itch.
One day I was like, I told my boss at the locksmith place, I was like, I want to go to school for a trade. And he goes, no, you don't need to go to school for locksmithing. So I'll just teach you everything. I was like, well, you don't know everything. So then I started looking at it. And right at the same time, I had a friend that put out a cookbook with his older brother, and I was like, well, if they can do that and they got no experience, I can go to culinary school with no experience. Never cooked a day in my life, and here I am, you know, almost 8 years later, executive chef of a yacht club here in Detroit, been on TV for cooking, done the whole gambit of it, and it's been a pretty good run.
I asked Jared how it was being on national TV.
Really strange, right? Because you're doing it and you don't really know what's happening. When you're doing it, you're just going through the motions every day. And then all of a sudden, you start to see yourself in commercials and on Facebook, on other people that are posting things and other social media. And then, you know, the owners of the restaurant I was at before, while it was airing, bought me a billboard. So every day when you would drive Woodward Avenue, you would see an 11-foot tall me. But 2 weeks ago, you would have never known who I was.
I ask, now that the show is over, what was the most frequently asked question Jared got? I know what had come to my mind.
What's Gordon Ramsay like in real life? And he, you know, he's a great guy. He expects perfection, and if you don't give it to him, he, you know, gets in your face because he knows you're capable of it. He doesn't think that you know you're capable of it, so he pushes you to what is your breaking point and gets you past it, and then just says, all right, there you go, see, you did it.
Since Jared Bopkin had cooked for Gordon Ramsay and other numerous famous people, I asked if he would make something for, well, me. So he described the summer salad that he would make.
I do it a little bit different here. It's not just tomato, mozzarella, basil, and balsamic. I add a little bit of corn relish to mine because, you know, corn is a huge Michigan product. So I do like a little corn, like an American-style corn salsa where it's corn, red onion, Fresno's chili, a little bit of white balsamic vinegar, a little bit of extra virgin olive oil, some fresh herbs, and I just put little piles of it on my caprese salad. So you get, you know, the tomatoes are tart and juicy, And then this corn is like sweet and it pops when you bite into it.
So we headed to the bustling Bayview Yacht Club kitchen where Jared does what he does best. He began chopping and dicing and pouring and described in detail the tomato burrata salad that was in store for me.
Two cobs of corn to half a red onion, finely minced. To one bunch of parsley, a small dime-sized bundle of chives chopped up finely. You know, it can obviously be more rustic if you would like. So that's just all about how you want to work your knife. And then you do about a tablespoon of extra virgin olive oil, and so that means a tablespoon of white balsamic vinegar. And you just kind of mix it all together. You season it with salt and pepper, and you set that to the side for now. Corn's nice and sweet. We're gonna toss it right in the bowl. We got some red onions that we're gonna finely mince. Like I said, we're making a salsa, right? So you just take your basic ingredients of a salsa, onion, corn because it's a corn salsa, some herbs. We're gonna throw it all in a bowl together. We got parsley and chives in here as well. And what we're gonna do is we're gonna add, normal salsas have tomatoes, but it's going on a tomato salad, so we don't have to add it in this situation. So we're just gonna add, it's caprese salad. It's always got balsamic instead of black balsamic.
And out came the fancy plates, and we headed out to the dock to enjoy the sunshine and the tomato burrato. And then I asked Jared the real meaning of food.
Best sound during family times is when everybody's just shoving food in their face. It's just silent, And you just look around, and you're around all the people you love and you enjoy spending time with, or, it's the reason you get together, like a Labor Day barbecue or, Christmas dinner or, Passover Seder. It's tradition, it's family, it's food. It's like, it's all encompassing. It pretty much hits all of those points in your life that you remember.
To get the full recipe and to see a picture of the recipe, and of course, Jared and I, head to WKAR.org or go to Current State's Facebook. For Current State, I'm Brooke Allen.
And coming up on Current State, did you know the U.S. Air Force has a jazz band? They're called the Airmen of Note, and they're spending a couple of days here in Michigan this Labor Day weekend. We'll speak with a member of the band and learn about the time he spent teaching kids at Michigan's Blue Lake Fine Arts Camp. That's coming up after the break on Current State. Don't forget the Current State podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get great podcasts. Everything we do on our program ends up there, as well as at WKAR.org. The demand for information technology professionals continues to grow, but according to various studies, student interest in STEM subjects, science, technology, engineering, and math, has declined. ITEC is a nonprofit that works to change that. It stands for Information Technology Empowerment Center, and it aims to improve performance in all these subjects, as well as in robotics, writing, and digital media. For Neighbors in Action this week, we're joined by ITEC's Executive Director, Kirk Riley. Kirk, welcome back.
Thanks, Mark. Good to be here.
And by Nancy Lubeski. Nancy is principal of Wexford Montessori Academy. Nancy, welcome.
Thank you very much.
Kirk, it's been a few years since you've been on Current State to talk about ITEC. Have you seen growth the last couple of years?
Absolutely. We've seen growth, particularly in our programs that do after-school math, the iMath program, where we serve about 250 students a year. Math is one of those subjects that no matter how excited we get kids about robotics or media or game design, if they're struggling in math, they're not going to go on in STEM. So we do full year after school math in the Lansing School District. We also have brought on the 2020 Girls Program, which are after school tech clubs for at-risk girls. Well, why girls? It's because 70 to 80% of the kids who would sign up for ITEC were boys. And of course, we want to accommodate every boy, but we want to provide that supportive environment where girls are going to do things like robotics and media and so on. Girls responded to that. We serve about 100 girls a year in various schools around Lansing.
We will go a little bit deeper into the 2020 girls and the IMath programs here with you, Nancy. But Kirk, I want to ask you first. You're finishing up a summer full of camps. How was the turnout at this summer?
Just fantastic. We did camps all over the Lansing area at our headquarters in the Foster Community Center, but also at places like Capital Area District Library, St. Vincent Catholic Charities. ITEC goes where the students are. It's an important part of our approach toward this. We take transportation away as a barrier. For the kids who do, transportation is absolutely one of those keys. And for the kids who do ITEC in the school, we provide them a ride home as well.
2020 Girls and IMath, two of ITEC's biggest programs. Nancy, you've got both of these programs at Wexford. Give us your perspective on the 2020 Girls program. How does it work? How does it play out over there?
First of all, I'd like to say that we're very pleased to have the ITEC programs at Wexford. It's been a wonderful opportunity for our at-risk students and every other young person to experience technology and really get their hands on different types of things that have come around that are new, that are innovative, that are creative, things that we can't necessarily offer during the daytime, during classes. They do attend after-school programs. The interest has been piqued by our staff members becoming involved, parents becoming involved, community members becoming involved, and a really hands-on approach to learning that's innovative and creative for our young people.
Do you work with a lot of at-risk youth?
Yes, we do.
Okay. And where does that name come from, 2020 Girls? Where's the 2020? What's that all about?
It simply came because in 2013, the year 2020 sounded like it was a long time away. And we want these girls to be looking to their future. And so we called it 2020 Girls. We are thinking as that year gets all the closer that we will draw a slash between the two 20s and it'll be looking clearly into the future, meaning 2020 eyesight. But that's where the name comes from.
What's an example of a game or an activity, Nancy, that gets girls engaged in these subjects?
The girls are very creative. They often create their own games with the assistance of the MSU mentors that come to work with them and the other community volunteers. One of our favorite activities at Wexford last year was when the girls designed little miniature robots, and they had to create a maze and program the robots to go through the maze.
Navigate the maze.
Yes, and it was very entertaining, and the students were very, very excited and enthusiastic.
It sounds very difficult as well.
It was.
Have you seen measurable results here? I mean, I imagine you must see some dramatic transformations, but what do you see from the beginning of the summer to the end, or from the beginning of a program to the end?
The biggest thing that we have noticed is, like I was saying, increased interest in technology, robotics, STEM subject areas. But what we can really see is the amount of confidence that the young people are gaining each and every time they meet with the ITEC program. They've increased confidence not only in the ITEC areas, but throughout the school day, classroom, other subject areas as well.
Mm. Kirk, I know you've got a story to share about a student from 2020 Girls.
I do. She actually did IMath as well as 2020 Girls. She started with the IMath program at Luton Elementary in the Lansing School District, and she was completely lacking in confidence. When she came to 2020 Girls, one of the things that they do is movie making, and Raquel wanted nothing to do with movie making. She didn't want the idea of being filmed and needing to be on camera was more than she could possibly do. She was reserved, shy. She didn't participate in group assignments, held back, and that really affected her progress in it. And we saw through the school year programs and especially toward the end of this summer, just a real transformation in her. She became a leader in the projects she was doing. She contributed ideas. She helped establish a welcoming environment for other campers. Her mom, in particular, discussed how happy she was that her daughter was part of 2020 Girls. Her mom, Maria, mentioned that Raquel had always been very shy and reserved, and she was now more outgoing and really believed that she could do anything that she wanted to do. That was the big transformation, her confidence in herself to achieve. So big changes.
I'm speaking with Executive Director of ITEC, Kirk Riley. And that stands for the Information Technology Empowerment Center. Also, Nancy Lubeski joins us. Nancy's principal of Wexford Montessori Academy. Nancy, let's go a little deeper on the iMath program at Wexford. How does that work?
It's a wonderful opportunity for our students to increase their skills in mathematics. They use computer-based software after school, and they do different types of instructional programs and tutoring programs via SuccessLine that we're not able to offer during the school day. They work with mentors, and the big part of the big success that he was talking about with Raquel, as well as the iMath program, is the ability to work with our mentors. They gain the one-on-one individualized attention. They look at the mentors as role models as well as instructors. They're an integral part of our community. And they really, really make a difference in our young people, working through the mathematics problems, coaching them forward, telling them, yes, you can do this. And then they've also brought in many, many guest speakers from the community to show the students that, yes, if you do this, you can have a career like this. These are some options for you. These are some opportunities. And really working on the areas that the students need help with.
Can you tell us about any students in particular who've really come alive or been inspired by these programs?
Absolutely. We've had iMath and 2020 Girls at Wexford the past 2 years. The first year of the program, we had a young man who was in fifth grade. And like Raquel, he was struggling academically and socially. He was in our iMath program and came into the program about a year and a half below his grade level in math. During the year with iMath, he was able to gain 2 years' growth in mathematics, and that was due in part to the program during the after school hours, and then also he did the tutoring program at home as well, working with his parents and other volunteers from the community, practicing what he had been learning at school during the iTech program. So he was able to gain a lot of growth.
How do you help boys? Is there an effort to help boys along the same ways, in the same ways that the 2020 Girls program helps girls?
Absolutely. A core piece of iTech that we've really not discussed here is the Tektronix program, and that is taking the same robotics programs, media, and so on that we've described, and doing them for both boys and girls. Those are the classes where we get 70 to 80% sign up by boys, so we have a significant portion. What's not, those are not year-long programs, and what we're kind of spotlighting here are these year-long, 2 days a week, where that we really make a profound impact on the students by having them come virtually every week of the school year to do iMath and 2020 Girls.
Kirk,
I'm going to touch on one thing that Nancy was saying, and that is the absolute importance of the relationships between the mentors, tutors, and the Lansing students. They gain confidence through that relationship. And Michigan State University students, want to make sure that this is well understood, Michigan State University students are usually our mentors and tutors. They're grad students, undergraduates at Michigan State. This is a great opportunity for them to be involved and really making a difference in these schools and in the lives of these kids.
Now, do the mentors get credit here if they're college students, for example, or do you also have a cadre of volunteers that are a part of this effort?
We have a great cadre of volunteers at iTech who do all kinds of things, but the mentors and tutors, we're asking them to come 2 days a week for an entire school year, and we pay them a nominal amount, but there's no way we could, Wexford, if you found Wexford Elementary, it's on the far side of Lansing, it's a 20-minute drive from here, so we're asking them to make a real time commitment. And the important thing is that we get them coming back year after year, hopefully for 3 to 4 years of their college experience, they're coming out to the schools. So it's necessary that we pay them.
Nancy, we got less than a minute, but just briefly talk to us about the kinds of characteristics that make a good volunteer or mentor.
Along in sync with the iTech program, we're looking at a holistic approach to educating the child with the Montessori methodology. So when they come to Wexford, we're looking for somebody who's very patient, very caring, very articulate, very invested in the children in our community.
I know you've got an event coming down the pipe about the bus. We're just about out of time. Is there a website where our listeners can go to learn about that?
Absolutely. Go to iteclansing.org, iteclansing.org, and simply click on volunteer, or you can read all about the bus. The bus is simply saying there are parts of this community that we can't reach with our programs because they don't have a computer lab. Let's put a lab onto a mobile platform.
How exciting.
And that's what we've done.
I've been speaking with Kirk Riley, the executive director of iTech, and with Nancy Lubeski, principal of Wexford Montessori Academy, about all of their various activities here on Current State's Neighbors in Action. Continued success.
Thanks for being here, Mark.
Thank you.
It's Current State on WKAR. They're not pilots, mechanics, or logistics officers, but a group of servicemen and women from the United States Air Force will be touring South Michigan this weekend. On Saturday afternoon at the Bandshell in Albion, and Sunday afternoon at the main stage of the Detroit Jazz Festival. They are the Air Force jazz band called the Airmen of Note. Yesterday, Current State's Jamie Paisley spoke with one of the musicians ahead of their swing through the Midwest.
He is Senior Master Sergeant Tyler Kubler, former music director of the Airmen of Note, because Tyler also recently elevated to overall supervisor of the ensemble. The Airmen of Note is made up of 17 instrumentalists, one vocal featured soloist, and a few audio engineers and support personnel in tow as well. However, five members of the band just returned to the United States after a tour abroad.
Yes, sir. That's an important part of our mission here at the United States Air Force Band, is the deployment aspect. And we did recently have five members that got pulled out of the Airmen of Note that formed a separate flight, and they were deployed to some of our forward locations overseas in support of our troops over there to bring morale and a little slice of home. So we're very proud of that mission and the performance of our members that have done that.
Yeah. Now, you yourself, I know you actually have a slight bit of a Michigan connection that you taught for a while or a clinician over at Blue Lake.
Yes, I was. I had a break in service, actually, in the Air Force. And while I was an assistant professor at a school in Illinois, I had the pleasure of teaching at the Blue Lake Fine Arts Camp for a summer or two. That was a really enriching experience for me personally, just to get that educational connection with the aspiring youth. Some amazing young players there, definitely, that go through that program.
And there's still that educational component, because you still head into schools and jazz clinics with students.
Yes, our program is actually called AIM, and that's an acronym. It stands for Advancing Innovation Through Music. And that's a big part of what we do. Every time we head out on tour and also in the local area, we try to reach out to local schools. We've gone into everything from elementary school all the way up to, college, university, and conservatories. And that's a big part of our mission, is to mentor and to reach out to students of all ages and help them with their careers, and also represent the excellence from our brothers and sisters in the United States Air Force. They can see firsthand what kind of stuff that we're doing as active duty airmen musicians.
Hmm. For this upcoming weekend, it's a three-day, essentially, tour that's bringing you out Midwest. You're starting off in Chicago, and then you've got two stops kind of in our listening area, one in the Albion Shell. They're swinging at the Shell program on Saturday the 3rd. It's all kind of culminating in the event that's happening Sunday in Detroit. And what is that event?
We're going to be one of the featured acts at the Detroit Jazz Festival. It's an international jazz festival. Some of the best jazz artists today will be playing there, and we're very proud to represent the Air Force there. This year, actually, we're going to have a couple of special guests, I believe, perform with us.
Mm.
We're going to have Jimmy Heath, incomparable tenor saxophonist, and the amazing vocalist Roberta Gamberini will also share the stage with us, as well as featuring members of the band. So it should be a really exciting concert. I believe we're performing at 2 o'clock. Of course, you can check the festival's website for more information, as well as our social media outlets, if you'd like to see us there.
That's right. 2 o'clock at the main stage of the Detroit Jazz Festival. That's Sunday. You can find that online at DetroitJazzFest.com. And speaking of, you mentioned before the different sort of recordings that you've done. The last recording that I know you've done is in 2012. There was the album called Compositions, dealing with works that were written by members of the Airmen of Note. Any other projects coming up on the horizon?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked that. We have a brand new CD that's just about ready to release. We're currently in post-production, and we'll be pressing the CD very soon. It's a tribute to the heritage and legacy of the Note as seen through the various chief arrangers for the Note. So we're highlighting the work of four gentlemen throughout the years that have really defined the sound of the band. And it's all previously unrecorded material, and it's a great mixture of old and new. And we're very excited to get that out to the public, and of course we'll upload that on our website so people can stream that for free.
The Airmen of Note, as an entity with the United States Air Force, it's an organization started in 1950. What can you tell us about the origins of the Airmen of Note and that long history?
Well, the Note was actually created in 1950 to carry on the legacy and the tradition of Major Glenn Miller's Army Air Force dance band. Many people, of course, know Glenn Miller as one of the most popular musicians of his day, and he ended up enlisting and leading his own band to support the troops, and of course lost his life in the service of his country. And the Airmen of Note is that direct descendant, so we've been created to carry on that tradition of innovation to this day, and it's something we're very proud of.
We're speaking with Senior Master Sergeant Tyler Kubler of the U.S. Air Force Airmen of Note, who will be appearing at free concerts this weekend in Michigan. First on Saturday afternoon at the Albion Victory Park Bandshell, and then Sunday afternoon on the main stage of the Detroit Jazz Festival. Tyler, as we talk about joining the ranks of the U.S. Air Force Airmen of Note, you obviously, you know, don't find people at various gigs and say, hey, you know, join us for a week. It's a very intensive process of becoming a serviceman or servicewoman of the U.S. Air Force. Walk us through what happens when a prospective performer wants to further their career in jazz with the Airmen of Note or any other, you know, of the musical outreach programs provided by the military.
Yeah, absolutely. The audition process for the United States Air Force Band is very rigorous, but open to all. We're equal opportunity, of course, and we welcome anybody is welcome to submit materials for a spot. Usually what happens is there's a specific chair that's vacated either by separation or retirement. And when that happens, we'll advertise in the trade papers and social media and universities, the standard channels. And then people will be required to submit both a recording of excerpts and specific examples that we'll post on our website, as well as a resume or a CV. And we'll usually get between 70 and 100 submissions on average for most of the chairs in the band. And then our committee will select finalists for a live audition here in Washington, D.C. And we'll bring those finalists in that have made the cut and have a very exhaustive day-long audition process that involves sight reading, prepared excerpts, improvisation, interviews with leadership, small group playing, all in an effort to identify the best candidate for the job. Mm. And once, of course, that we've picked somebody, they're required to enlist in the United States Air Force, and they'll go through basic training down in San Antonio and become active duty, and then we'll come back up here and be assigned to the band.
Fantastic. Which begs the question, then, how long has it been since you have been a member of the Airmen of Note?
I originally joined in 1998 and had a six-year break in service from 2002 to 2008. I finished my doctorate and was a professor of music at a university in Illinois, but I had the chance to rejoin the band in 2008 and jumped at it. I missed the service component, and it was a good fit for me to come back.
Yeah, the U.S. Air Force Airmen of Note are performing this Saturday, September 3rd at 3 p.m. A free concert at the Albion Victory Park Bandshell. More information at swingingattheshell.com, as well as a free concert Sunday at 2 o'clock, the main stage of Detroit Jazz Festival. More information about that at DetroitJazzFest.com. And you can also find out more about the Airmen of Note at usafband.af.mil, or you can check out their Facebook page at Airmen of Note. Senior Master Sergeant Tyler Kubler, thanks very much for speaking with us.
Thank you so much for having me, and we look forward to seeing your listeners out at one of our concerts.
For Current State, I'm Jamie Paisley.
And that's Current State for today. We are going to take a break for a few days. We wish you all a safe and happy Labor Day weekend. Listen tomorrow and Friday for encore editions of Current State. Then on Labor Day, join us for a special program, How Drones Are Reshaping the World. It's part of our America Abroad series. Drones are revolutionizing the skies. We'll learn what happens when practically everyone has drones, from the major world powers to the smallest non-state actors, including Hezbollah, Hamas, and ISIS. How Drones Are Reshaping the World, Monday at 9 and 6 on 90.5 FM. We'll be back on Tuesday with a fresh edition of Current State. We hope you can join us then. We look forward to our storytellers tonight at Red Cedar Spirits in East Lansing. We're sold out. We're looking forward to it at 6 o'clock. The heat is on for storytellers tonight in East Lansing. The executive producer of Current State is Peter Wharf. Kevin Lavery directed the show today. Thanks also to Scott Pohl, Katie Cook, Jamie Paisley, Brooke Allen, and to Drew Hill. The Current State podcast, there, anywhere, anytime, at iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. We hope to see you soon. It's Current State on 90.5.